you know, any model of governance or of organization, it's, you know, it's equally absurd to, and also especially, you know, for me, who comes from a country with questionable democracy but definite capitalism, it would not be appropriate to, in a way, try and romanticize or even make any judgments about, for example, what it might have been like to live under a communist rule. There are, of course, many types of communism, just as there are many types of capitalism. And so I want to be very clear that what it is that I'm criticizing is not capitalism per se, but really a very specific form of capitalism. And I think, you know, the big myth during the 1960s in the West was that the biggest threat to capitalism and democracy came from communism and Russia. In fact, the biggest threat came from within capitalism itself. And so this neoliberalism is really like a counter-revolution. And so it should not be viewed, in my opinion, as the natural consequence of capitalism, but really as a kind of hijacking of another system. And so what I'll present today is two architectural projects and some kind of preamble in order to show what types of strategies I think might be possible to imagine a different form of capitalism. So the other sort of brief comments I have, I mean, let me just describe these two graphs to you. On the left you have things which have been going up since 1974, and on the right you have things that have been going down. And as you can see, wages on the right there have basically flatlined. I mean, in real terms, a minimum wage in Britain today is about two-thirds of what it was in 1974. So in real terms, people can buy less. They're much poorer now than they were before. You can also see that both public and private housing have taken a real nosedive. On the left, meanwhile, there are three very interesting factors. One is household debt. One is social inequality, and the other is house prices. Effectively, what happened was, in Britain in the 1970s, there was like a mini crisis which occurred right before the oil shock. So it's often neglected from British economic history because it's concealed by the oil crisis. It actually was a housing crash. What happened was banks overextended themselves during the 1960s when they were building lots of social housing, and then suddenly found that the people that they lent money to, this is in the early part of 1973, they realized they couldn't pay it back. And it's effectively exactly what happened in 2007. And it caused the entire crash out of the, what's called the secondary banking system in Britain, which was all the small banks. They were bailed out by the government, and they were rolled up and sold to the big banks, which is why now in Britain we really only have kind of four or five banks. But the important moment for that is that in that process there was a decoupling along with deindustrialization and the opening of Britain's economy to the world under Thatcher. There was a decoupling of wages and house prices. I mean, it used to be the case that your wage went up and the house prices went up accordingly, so everything was in relative equilibrium. The supply of housing was going up. So, you know, that wasn't posing a problem. But what happens at this moment is that the economists realize that production is no longer going to be possible under growth through production is not going to be possible in the new British economy. And what they realize is the only way they're going to be able to preserve rising purchasing power if wages are going to stagnate is by increasing personal debt. Now, in order to guarantee that personal debt, they required something which was always going to go up in value, so that if the person defaulted, they would be able to reclaim the money. And they decided that that thing was going to be a house. And so you have, on the one hand, a sudden and insane desire in Britain for people to own their own houses, and this concept of home ownership becomes very powerful from this period onwards. And you have, accordingly, a rise in personal debt and a rise in other forms of debt, which goes along with it. And because the payments from these mortgages and the payments on the credit cards and so on is funneling that money back into the financial institutions, you effectively have a mechanism for wealth redistribution, which takes from the middle and lower classes and distributes it to the elite. And that's really, when I talk about neoliberalism, I'm not talking about other forms of capitalism that may have existed before. I'm talking about an extremely specific project, which was to redistribute wealth from the middle classes to an elite. So that was just something to bear in mind when I use this term neoliberalism. That's what I mean. Just a couple of other quick points. I mean, there's a very interesting kind of, we've talked about blind spots in problematizing design, and this idea that, you know, architects always deal with problematics, or they're constantly trying to form problems. I mean, one of the things which I find very interesting is that architects are very good at thinking about problems like materiality and technology and environment and these, you know, engineering and so on. But they very rarely consider two aspects. One is they very rarely consider finances as a design parameter. And they also very rarely consider the structure of their own firms as a design problem. And one of the things that Rem Koolhaas did was he employed a man called Paul Nakazawa from the Harvard Business School to design AMO and OMA. I mean, to design the structure of the firm, because an architect is not capable of designing the structure of their own firm. I find this a very kind of interesting question. You know, we also talked very briefly about the idea of the house as an investment, which is also a very new concept, and which goes directly with this kind of question of property and ownership, which I would resist. And perhaps finally, I would just say that, you know, I don't want to present solutions, and I'm not presenting you with problems. What I want to be very clear about is that I'm presenting certain strategies. And the difference between this is that, you know, a problem demands a solution which implies an endpoint to a process. You know, a strategy is really about a particular movement through a terrain or through a battlefield of conditions, which is very important to me. So I'm going to be quite rigorous about the definition of subversive opportunism and try and incorporate some of the other ideas which have been going on today. But it was really kind of, it's not a term I've ever heard before. I didn't really understand what it meant. And so for me, I went back to kind of my classical Marx and thought about what he would say. The kind of context or the starting point for my proposition is that in classical Marx, you have two forms of value, use value and exchange value. You know, use value, which is very literal, I must drink water or I'll die, and an exchange value, which is really a kind of invention or fiction based on the attributed value of all other things in the circle of exchange. So, you know, the value of a bottle of water is very low because relative to other commodities, there's a lot of it. But nonetheless, the relationship between the two, you know, this holds true for labor power, for example. The value of labor is directly attributable to the production of the worker, or currency. You know, the value of the currency is attributable to the gold, which is often considered to be a kind of in between use and exchange, which backs the currency. So you have these kind of symbols or signs, like labor, like currency, with these values, which are nonetheless tied back to some form of use or some real-world relationship. And unfortunately, what has occurred, which Marx could never have foreseen, is the uncoupling of the sign from its referent. We now have a kind of form of simulation or a form of simulacrum, which are in constant flux and which are, in fact, not referring to anything. And as a result, what you remain... in fact, this form of exchange is only possible because the things in it have no actual value. But what you have that remains is a machine of exchange and the structure of exchange. And what we were talking about earlier today is very much this idea in which, in a way, you can change the value of the differing signs. You can change these entities which are in constant flux, but you cannot change the machine of exchange itself. And that seems to be, for me, you know, one of the big problems. I mean, you know, what really determines the value of Angry Birds? It's like, it's a philosophical question. And what determines the value of your labor now that, as we've described, you're no longer producing products? You're not producing, you simply are kind of dealing in products. You're almost like a manager of something which is not tangible but immaterial, you know, designs, reports, and drawings. And what does the money that you're paid with even represent, since we know that it's not backed by a gold standard? It's like a it's a fiat currency. It exists because we all believe it exists. It's created by invisible digital spreadsheets. Because there's no standard, gold standard behind currency, and there's no gold standard to value, all values are in constant uncertainty and constant flux. And because of this condition, this form of capitalism I'm describing is in constant crisis because of the constantly shifting values within it. And this crisis is really the context for opportunism, which I would describe as really like the compulsion towards arbitrage. I mean, when you do, when you trade foreign currencies, there are moments at which the two currencies being traded are not equivalent to each other. There's a very small period of time in which there's a discrepancy. And if you can capitalize on that, if you can get in there and see that opportunity, then you can make a lot of money. But it's temporary, and this is what opportunism for me is as well. It's a question of the unexpected windfall. It's the accidental profit. As a result, opportunism is integral to neoliberalism, and it also, I don't think, can be ideological, because it's short-termist and it's accidental, and therefore it's temporary, and therefore, in my opinion, non-strategic. The instability of a system of exchange without real value is what Baudrillard calls symbolic exchange. And it's very, we were talking earlier about kind of Foucault and Guattari and Deleuze. It's very nice to see their descendants, who are really the Italian operismo movement, people like Maurizio Lazzarato, Biffo Berardi, and Paolo Verno, beginning to pick up on this concept of symbolic exchange as being the other half of biopolitics, and the idea of a system which is so hyperstable because it possesses no reference of its own. This symbolic exchange produces very high levels of precariousness. We should ask ourselves questions, you know, where will we be in 10 years, and what will we be doing? How will we live? Who will we live with? But even, you know, in shorter periods of time, where will we be in 6 months? What will your condition be like? And we don't know, but we do hope nonetheless for some surprise or some accident or some unexpected opportunity which will deliver us from the stability of our condition. And perhaps this, you know, the trick of this system is the hope that it offers, because it appears to be better than the alternative, which is a life that's both predictable and predicted. So, you know, neoliberalism offers us, on the one hand, freedom and flexibility by making everything temporary. You can do what you want, you can be your own boss, but you're also responsible for yourself, and, you know, you can't count on anyone. So there's also an element of risk associated with this kind of hope. You have to make your own opportunities. It offers us temporary contracts, short leases. It's a kind of Airbnb, pay-as-you-go, freelance type of ideology. And because everything is up in the air at once, it means that the stress of making decisions about today distracts us and makes it impossible for us to make decisions about tomorrow. And while neoliberalism is shortening your horizon and making you, like, desperate and opportunistic, it's distracting you from the real project, which is the long-term one, and which is simply your enslavement by debt. Through the mortgage, through the credit card, through the student loan, because when you borrow money, you sell your future, and you guarantee that tomorrow is the same as today. And that is really the stability of the system. So in every case, we must resist debt. You know, personally, I owe £40,000 for my architectural education. It's totally worth it. And it's a government loan, but that government, my government has sold it to a private loans company for a variable interest rate. So the interest rate goes up and down all the time, mostly up. I have no idea how long it will take me to pay off this loan, but probably several decades. So, you know, I don't know where I will live in 6 months, but I know for sure that I will be paying off that loan. And my options are limited. This freedom is a kind of an illusion. So, you know, how can I really be subversive within this context? It's very difficult because I'm owned by the system. They bought me, or rather more properly, I sold myself, which is where the kind of self exploitation comes in. So, you know, you can see that I'm very skeptical about either opportunism or subversion within this model, because neither of them seem to offer ways out from the potential pitfalls of the system. So you might ask what I propose in its place. And at least for me, a concept which is very powerful is the Trojan horse. I'm sure you know the story. It's a very precise, it's a monofunctional weapon. And the design of every component reinforces the general aim, which might seem absurd, which is the toppling of an entire civilization. I mean, the Greeks are trying to destroy the Trojans. But from that goal, you know, the design of the wheel, whether or not the horse can roll across sand, whether or not the hatch is visible from the outside, whether or not they have enough wood in their boats in order to make the correct shape of a horse, all of these relatively minor design questions contribute towards the general aspiration. And for me, this is very much the opposite of opportunism. You know, it's not about taking advantage of situations as they appear to you. It's about following a series of very small and seemingly insignificant actions which contribute towards some particular ideological aim. So, you know, I mean, who are our Trojans that we're fighting? There are two scales of spatiotemporal exploitation: the long-term debt slavery and the short-term crisis management. And what I'm going to show you is two projects which attempt to deal with both of those scales in different ways. The first one is called the ingot, and it really comes from the idea of taking finance as a design parameter and really designing first through... I'll show you this then. When developers think about architecture, and you know, we mentioned this before, that there's this kind of parallel narrative to the way in which we're designing, they really conceive of buildings as like a combination of three factors, which is space, time, and money. And what they're trying to do is to create the densest, cheapest, and quickest type of construction. And so my initial starting point was to say, well, what happens if we begin to uncouple these parameters, and what happens if we begin to design with a bias towards one or the other? And what I realized very quickly was that time is really the one that offers us the most form of resistance against neoliberalism. And as soon as you begin to manipulate the parameter of time in debt, you end up with very different conditions. You know, for example, if you were to pay off a home loan over 25 years, you know, the payments each month are quite high. If you pay it over 80 years, like they do in Japan, where you have a multi-generational mortgage, you end up paying a lot more in interest, but the loan payments each month are very small. So I took these different parameters and began to imagine what the relationship between them might be, how we deal with the area of construction, the area of the land, the cost of the land, the cost of construction. And what I created was effectively a financial algorithm which generated architectural solutions based on the idea of effectively a corporate bond. So it's basically a very long-term mortgage. You know, an example of this would be to take a site in the City of London. We know how much it costs per square meter, so we know already what the cost of the site is, and we know in order to equal that, what sort of building needs to be built on it under certain kind of financial parameters. Now, a normal developer will break even and then they'll add another 20%. And in Britain, unless a developer can get that extra 20%, they don't bother. You know, if we were to use a corporate bond mechanism, we can already reduce the volume of the building while maintaining all the other... I mean, you can see here it's producing 7.5% over 25 years, which is a very good investment. You know, good luck finding anyone who'll give you 7.5% now, except perhaps like Nigerian government bonds. As we begin to manipulate the parameter of space and time, you can see on the left there the bond term is registering 25 years. As the height goes up, the market rate that we would charge for an apartment comes down. So, you know, you can see instantly the relationship between these. You know, by the time we hit 230 meters in 30 years, we've lowered the rate that we're paying, but we've already dropped down to 58% of the market rate. You know, this kind of, obviously, the higher you go, the better it gets. And then within those, you can begin to tweak certain factors. Now, what I should also say is, on the left here, this figure, the S106. In Britain, there's effectively a bribe, which is you can pay for extra building height if you give the government, if you give your local government money towards particular projects. So, for example, I'm sure you've seen the Shard in London. The height for that building, which is 315 metres, was originally 65 metres, but they gave £50 million to the railway station that's below it, and they were given the extra 200 metres in height. So what I'm proposing is that within this algorithm, you also have a means of factoring in that. And so this percentage here is the amount that you're giving to the local government. And in exchange for 15% of the building, you get about an extra 220 meters of height. And that in itself can be very useful, because when you look at what people want in their local area, you can simply take those statistics and project it into floor area to provide the communal services of the building. This is really like form follows finance. I mean, it's what a lot of people would not even really consider to be architecture, because it's so far removed from, let's say, any of the design parameters that we would normally consider. I mean, there was also a kind of neoliberal twist, which is the internal arrangement of the building is completely freeform, because after all, I mean, if we think of Hilbersheimer and the abstraction of capital and real estate, you know, you're not really renting an apartment, you're just renting square meterage. So presumably you rent 36 square meters and you just go and carve it up like they do in the, you know, a converted warehouse, and you do with it what you will, and you live in the form and structure as you would like. There was another element, which is that the building itself is coated, plated in gold, which apart from being a really fantastic material from the durability of the building, because you remember that this building has to stand for 50 years in order to maintain its financial obligations, so it needs to have very low maintenance. But also you can use the money which is invested in the facade as a form of speculation. So you can use the building itself as a form of financial derivative in order to pay for other things. And that's it, that's the ingot. But, you know, even like the gold facade, it's not gratuitous. These details contribute to the general goal, which is to use long-term investment in order to reduce the cost of rental in the center of the city, to produce high quality, because, of course, it has to be very durable architecture, and to undermine neoliberalism by creating these kind of very long-term stable rents. And most of all, you take the land out of the market. One of the things that I feel very passionately about is the abolition of private property exchange in Britain. I'm not advocating it everywhere, but within Britain, it's really been a source of incredible evil over the last five or six centuries. And, you know, we really need to get onto that. One of the other, and this leads me into the second project, one of the other things which was very present in my mind during this design process was the subjectivity of the people who lived there. These kind of precarious, anonymous metropolitans suffering from anomie, you know, with trapped in kind of jobs which they do with a very kind of half-hearted interest, frustrated and consumed by their desire for things which are beyond their... and actually, I should say this project took place in the context of the London riots, while people were breaking in and stealing white trainers from stores. So I was very interested by the subjectivity and of course the role of architecture in reinforcing certain types of class and power relations, not only financially, as in the previous project, but physically. And so I was very interested in the kind of typologies. And we imagine that the way that we live today is a very natural way of living, but very modern inventions with very specific intentions. You know, you look at Versailles, there are no corridors. The corridor didn't exist. It's not really until the 18th century that you see the corridor emerge at exactly the same time that the concept of the invention of privacy from your servants, the distinction of you as being two separate and antagonistic classes, emerges. You know, it's also true of the single-person bedroom, which didn't really exist in Britain before 1850, and is really a kind of product of industrial revolution and the desire to create a nuclear family that can be surveilled. Even the kitchen, as we use it today, is really only from the 1920s. So my question in this project, which is housing for the 99%, was how can we use architectural typologies as a weapon against certain types of power relations, and particularly against the class system in the UK. After the Great Fire of 1666, when most of London burnt down, there was an attempt to rebuild the city as a kind of ideal European capital. Actually, the plans look a lot like the old centre of Vilnius. I mean, this is what they imagined London would look like. And the citizens rejected it because they rejected the reappropriation of land that would be required to achieve this. So instead, the planners decided that they would have to design from the scale of the house up. And they also did it through the segmentation and parcelization of land. They took an acre, they divided it again, and that's how they created the terrace row. They put two of them next to each other, and that's basically about 80% of London looks like this. And they then dictated that there would only be four classes of house, one for the aristocracy, one for the professional class, one for the middle or commercial class, and one for the working class. And the you'll notice, I don't know if you can really see from there, but the plans are all basically the same at different scales, two rooms and a hallway. And they're all the same, regulated in their dimensions in order to give you the same degree of profitability per acre. And basically the strength of the British power class system is, in my opinion, directly attributable to the regulation of the housing typologies, which existed really unchanged for almost 400 years. This is why, you know, you can see the acres in play here in Kensington, in one of the wealthiest neighbourhoods, or equally in Kensal Rise, which is one of the poorest neighbourhoods. And it's effectively the same system with you know, different class of housing on it. So the project really attempted to invert or resist individuation, which is the splitting of the individual and the focusing in order to exploit them further. And rather than having this kind of party wall system, I wanted to begin by removing as much as possible the distinction between properties. So you end up with this kind of typology, which is a kind of inversion, in which rather than having the walls support the structure, there's a core which supports these cantilevered floors. It's a brass-plated steel core, because again, the financial mechanism that allows this to exist requires that it survive for 100 years. So now, how do you design, if we imagine that 100 years ago there were no private bedrooms and no modern kitchens, how can we design a building for 100 years into the future? What sort of life will people have? What sort of form of life will that take? And so my response to this was to produce not something which is infinitely flexible. I mean, we know from the Pompidou that these models in architecture very rarely work. People put the walls in once and then they never move them again. So what you can do, by contrast, is create adaptable architecture. On the one hand, you have the incredible durability and stability of the core, within which you run all of your services with enough space to accommodate services that we can't imagine yet, into which go pieces of furniture which solve all of our functional requirements. And the ambition was very much to design a space in which it was awkward to add any furniture. I mean, one of the things which I think binds us to our desire and consumerist desire is the fact that we have more and more storage in our houses and we fill it up with more and more shit. I mean, this, for me, the only piece of furniture you required when you move in is a chair. Well, maybe we talk about that later. But from this design of the core with its variations and different possibilities, we can see that because the walls are no longer load-bearing, the possibility for different forms of life within the same structure through time is possible. We also, there's a kind of like a gestalt desire, so that the many buildings next to each other have a very different effect on the urban environment than just a single one. It's this question of anonymity, no longer being able to see where an individual lives. It's breaking down the ability to be surveilled. Which also breaks down the limits of the street. I mean, it's very ambiguous because of the nature of the ground floor of these buildings, where the limit of private and public property is, and what constitutes that public domain. This is also true in the reverse, in which what you do is you begin to remove all of the little fences which characterize British obsession with ownership, and you create this real ambiguity. And in fact, the attempt is to demolish the basic distinction in architecture, which is between front and back. You know, there is no longer a public or a private. It's really all areas of the city become potentially accessible, down to the fact that the ground floor of these buildings would have to, because of the nature of the structure, be always a communally occupied space. In section, you know, the way the stairs work is also very much the same, in that as soon as you have two next to each other, the system forces you to enter your building through an adjacent building. So if you live on the top floor, you have to enter five doors down. Your postal address is no longer the same as your physical address. And once again, we can begin to resist this desire to constantly categorize the individual in very kind of metric terms. Yeah, you've got your core, it's doing its things, you've got the chair. You have, as a result of this structure, even more so than something like Maison Domino, which is actually a very rigid typology, and you can't remove an edge column, for example. The idea behind this is that although the column itself remains quite stable, you can begin to cut into it and form new types of spatial arrangements and new forms of life, and especially forms of communal living, which might not occur to us now or seem improbable now, but which might take place in the future. And really it's a resistance of all the forms of exploitation I've described. It's an attempt to use domesticity as a weapon to resist certain types of power segregation and class segregation. Although the design of these spaces, I think it's also very important to say that, you know, the title of the project, which is Cenobium, is a monastic term, which means the possibility of living alone. In order to have a monastery in which everyone is contributing towards a common ideology through common rituals like prayer and eating, you have to be able to retreat. And I would say that community is only possible when we have also the possibility of being by ourselves. So this is, you know, on a different time scale and in a different manner, trying to resist in a more, let's say, architectural manner, through the literal spaces which are occupied by people, a resistance to overconsumption, a resistance to this problem of precariousness versus debt. That's it. I mean, I would probably conclude by saying that Zizek has a great quote, which is that if you force, you know, capitalism only exists by periodically transcending itself, breaking its own rules. If you can force capitalism to be consistent at moments at which it cannot afford to be consistent, it will destroy itself. There's an alternate history in the way in which perhaps nation states never bailed out the banks in 2007. I mean, the Darwinian logic of capitalism should have said that the entire economy should have failed and society should have failed with it. I mean, that's the logic, right? But it only continues in this kind of zombie neoliberalism precisely because rules were transcended and the logic of the system was broken. And if you can put pressure on the system to be consistent at exactly the moment at which it cannot afford to be consistent, you put the whole system into an existential pressure. And that's very much what I've tried to do, especially with the ingot, by using not a resistance or subversion or a dissident form of capitalism, but a form which is already perfectly accepted within capitalism itself, in order to do exactly the opposite of what capitalism wants to do right now. If the pinnacle of neoliberal architecture was the museum or cultural center, because it's complicit in the reinforcement of these power structures, I would suggest that the only task of architecture today must be the domestic, and it must be to manifest social equality in really the mundane and the everyday. And it may not be especially glorious or splendid like the Bilbao Museum, but that's what's necessary. And in a way, we need to use exactly what we're not supposed to look at, which is the long term, and use the 5, the 10, the 50-year plan as a site for strategic resistance.
How do you say presentation from this project, I also, of course, things that comes to mind in the tactics that you could see in Arches Super Studio in something like that.
Yeah.
This kind of ambiguity between a dystopian and utopian views.
Mm.
It's going with the system, explaining it, and it becomes a, well, it's a bit, it's slightly different though, because there, because it was pushed to an end where it became unbearable, that no one would desire that, you could desire the imagery. But here it's like more of a logic that also provides an opening or a kind of an escape through, but this is all propelled through neoliberalism, acceptance.
I don't know if you've ever spent any time on a boat or a ship. If you're in under certain circumstances, we can accept very radically different forms of life and very radically different forms of relationship to our bodies. You know, on a boat, you try to make yourself basically invisible because otherwise you get in the way of everything and all the other people, and there's an enormous amount of conflict. So, and this, it's also a very kind of strangely both claustrophobic and agoraphobic experience of being both in the middle of nothing and very much limited by the... So, these types of spatial conditions can give forth very radically different forms of life. And what I'm suggesting is that as soon as we begin to think about the long term, as soon as we begin to think that tomorrow will not be the same as today, we open up the possibility for all sorts of different forms of life. I mean, if we imagine how people lived in monasteries in the 1500s, if we imagine, almost any kind of potential scenario, even if we think back to, let's say the Soviet era of the 70s, when Khrushchev was knocking up these K7 blocks, these massive platen bars, even the form of life which took place inside those is already radically different from anything which exists today, even in the same location. So what I'm suggesting is that as soon as you begin to play with that dimension, you enter a realm of unpredictability. And rather than trying to propose either a utopia or a dystopia, I'm simply trying to propose the possibility of an alternative, which is what is totally absent from our current system. That's the famous Thatcher saying, there is no alternative. Free market economics is the only solution. And I want to suggest that even within the logic of, maybe this is the subversive element, although I'm not really a threat from this, but even within the system itself, the logic, it, by its own rules, allows you to disprove itself. Went on a bit of an ideological...
There has been a big discussion in Stockholm about precisely the kind of housing that we were showing, the way that that's built and operated.
Mm.
So it's developed by on speculation, and it's built by builders. They create an interim homeowning association that is kind of a ghost function.
Yeah.
That, and then they sell off all the apartments, and then that's shifted from one of them to the other.
Yeah.
And then they go out and they have responsibility that is maybe 10 years, 15 years guarantee of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they are, since they're never building, they're not building to manage over time.
Mm.
So that means that there is a completely, in order to, the way you make money is of course to not to think in long-term costs.
No.
Because this is not your problem.
You exactly.
You have a 10, 15-year horizon.
Yeah.
And in order, but when you sell them, there is a financial cost that has to do with this maintenance and upkeep and so on.
Of course.
And in order to postpone that payment somehow, there have been this, loans that you pay off over a ridiculous period of time. That's like, in one extreme example, it was 1,000 years.
You think
that you build these houses,
and
they are extremely poor when it comes to material and choices and so on. But they also, financially, they will last for 1,000 years. And this is something that now the current government stopped. It's because it's not... it's against common sense, I guess, and it's not fair for the people living as well. But that also means that it will drastically increase the costing for all these new homeowners associations, which means that they are now sitting on a kind of time bomb. So this is a big struggle to offset these costs and so on. So I'm trying to say here is that I think that for architects to engage like you do in the kind of financial realities that are that are extremely abstract, that are complicated and so on. They're not difficult in that way, but you have to engage with it somehow. But they are very different from, as precisely what you say, what is, for instance, taught in a conventional school of architecture, I would say. That is very material and navigate into aspect. Kind of durability is a...
Well, but of course we're not encouraged to, because it would be against the logic of the system. I mean, it would be disadvantageous if you were a developer to hire an architect and for them to say, well, what's your social responsibility on this project? I mean, that would be not ideal. But the models, I think, already exist. I mean, there's nothing in what I've proposed is, let's say, revolutionary. There's nothing which is unorthodox. But nonetheless, they're models which don't exist in Britain, or combinations of models which don't exist in Britain. I mean, a big precedent for me has been Vienna. You know, Vienna has 53% of the housing controlled by the state, 60 or 70 if you consider also that they have influence over housing associations. But the majority of the property is owned communally or through a kind of bond system. So it makes it very difficult to trade property. It makes it almost impossible to speculate on property. As a result, you know, Vienna never had a housing crisis, hasn't entered recession since 2007, 2008. It's doing perfectly well. And I attribute that largely to the stability of its housing stock, in which you have affordable rents of high quality. And they're done that way through at times often quite complex, but effectively through communal ownership. And the reason that I believe in these very much is, first of all, because it's very rarely a large state entity. It's normally done on a building-by-building basis, which means that the people who are invested in it have a real interest in the property itself. And the other reason that I believe in it is because it is the possibility for the exchange of land, which is the real problem with the speculation. As soon as you make it impossible for the land itself to be sold, you remove almost all of the evils of the housing market. So, you know, the problem that you're describing in Sweden is not that people want to make a profit from private housing. That intrinsically is not necessarily a negative thing. The problem is that the people who are making it want to sell it and pass it on to someone as quickly as possible. And the people who are buying it also have in mind, as you described, an interest in preserving the value. But, you know, as I described, these values are all insubstantial. They're not attached to anything. They're all perceptual. So you have this real problem of potential crisis at any moment. I think
I have maybe some questions, because you started to talk about this use and exchange value.
Yeah.
And then I'm seeing like the last draft about the flat, which is like super empty.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, in German, does this term like a cat like bites in himself or itself in his own tail? Because like this exchange value, it's kind of important to make up identity or something. And when I was visiting the East Chinese house in LA, I saw the structure like super minimal. But then you kind of see, hey, they're living there for 40 years and they're putting so much identity and little pieces inside. And it's not about anonymity anymore. It's it speaks so much.
Well,
so I'm wondering, how much deductism is in this approach to be so minimal?
Well, I mean, minimalism, because you have to be very careful with minimalism, because it often gives it's often used by the elite as a tool to dissimulate their wealth. So, you know, you look at this great section from The Road to Wigan Pier by George Orwell. In which he describes the fact that only the rich man is happy with dry captain's biscuits and a glass of orange juice for breakfast. You know, the people who are living on unemployment benefits are always looking, because they live in perpetual misery, are always looking for the little ice cream, the little sugar in the tea, the little thing that alleviates their condition. It's only when you achieve this kind of higher state of being that you can be like. It's only when you're Steve Jobs. I don't know if you've seen this picture of Steve Jobs when he first moved into his house with his kind of legs crossed and a cup of tea, and all he has in the room, he has no furniture, he just has a record player in the corner. It's like, it's only when you have the largest corporation on earth that you're able to sit there with no objects whatsoever. So, I mean, I'm very aware of the fact that objects will enter into this. But one of the things that, one of the things that actually I borrowed from Scandinavia was the idea of a furniture library, the idea that what you do is you, in fact, rather than buying your own furniture from IKEA, which is shitty and needs to be replaced every couple of years, and you can never take it apart and put it back together, that there is a communal stockpile of very high quality furniture which is lent out to people. And as soon as you use a mechanism like that, you break the bond that someone has with the object. You break the desire, because you already give them a sense that they are responsible for the object for someone else. And that doesn't mean that you can't form your own identity through effectively shopping through the thing. Or, you know, I mean, there could be many ways in which you're able to form individuality. I would also suggest, in relationship to your own work, that the way in which you present yourself, your identity, no longer is limited to just the physical world. And the way in which you portray yourself through your panoply of heavily curated online personas is just as important to, let's say, the decoration of your bedroom. And in any case, in every space, there's always the possibility that I've designed for you to effectively have your own small booth where you can sleep or where you can work, because it's very important, I think, to be able to be alone, and presumably you can decorate that however you want. I mean, you know, it's a fine line as far as fascism and totalitarian decree goes in this second project, and I'm not comfortable with that, but, and I'm aware of that as a problem. But nonetheless, in trying to propose some alternative to the present, this was the best I could do.
No, I totally see this. It's just like, I think the history proved that, like, people exactly like won't have this lifestyle kind of. Like they go into the alarm and they
But what I would argue is that people will accept any circumstances if there's a financial motivation. Actually, I mean, I believe very powerfully in this, because this is the driving ideology of neoliberalism. It's like, if I can provide you with something which is £10 cheaper than another option. You know, look at this. I don't know if you've been following this independence debate in Scotland, but the two sides, basically, one says you'll be £1,500 better off if you vote for independence, and the other says you'll be £2,500 worse off. So it's like an entire nation is voting on its sovereignty based on a couple of £1,000. I mean, this whole metrics of profit and loss seem completely absurd when you transport it into questions which are not related to that. And so for me, you know, in this case, you're providing something at 48% of the market cost. Are there enough people in London who would accept a space like this? The condition is you can only bring a chair. Yeah, that seems kind of shitty. But on the upside, it's very cheap, and you can live there with guaranteed rent for 50 years. So, I mean, you know, these types of, let's say, moral priorities, I think, are things which I'm still exploring.
I find it interesting that you start off with the kind of, that this condition that we're in is also the condition that will be that one that governs the projects. Like, we're talking also a little bit, like, it's not only that the capitalist has changed completely from what it was, also the idea of the subject has changed. So I was wondering a little bit, like, how would you think that this would affect the idea of what it means to be subject?
Well, I think it's very interesting. My grandmother was born in 1904, and she died in 2008 at 104. And she came from New York. And so she grew up, you know, she was a teenager. She was, a child during World War I. She was a married woman during World War II. She lived most of the period that I'm in now, during the Great Depression in America. And she came from quite a poor family. And, you know, when she died in 2008, she had sorbet sherbet ice cream in her freezer, which had expired in 1988. And she never threw anything away. She had, like, massive piles of plastic bags. And in a way, you can see the impact of a particular era that was very formative on her, carrying all the way through her life in her subjectivity. I think it's not at all a kind of surprise. Like, the first, I would say, really adult moment that I had in my life was probably 9/11. I was 13, and it was the first time that I had really properly considered, you know, global geopolitical condition. If you imagine an adulthood, a formative period which stretches between 9/11 and the financial crisis, it's hardly surprising that the subjectivity that I'm proposing is one which is effectively founded on austerity. I mean, it's the rejection of surplus. It's this kind of, I would say, quite austere and quite monastic form of life. But personally, it's something that I really am trying to move towards, because everything else seems to be a trap. Everything else involves debt, and everything else involves me making commitments that I can't break. As far as subjectivity into the future, I can already see a generation below me, even just 5 or 10 years younger than me. There are people at my university who are 18 now, who have totally different priorities and values and subjectivity. I mean, that's a generation that grew up with ubiquitous hardcore porn, and you can see it in the architecture. It's a very kind of strange phenomena. So, I mean, I can't even begin to predict what it will be like in 30 or 40 years, but what I can say is that, in as much as I am possible, I think it is very important to move towards goals that you think are important, like social equality. For me, that's kind of the biggest one. And therefore, as an architect, what sorts of architectural projects can I take on or can I initiate in order to move towards that goal? And the rest of it is in constant flux. So we'll have to see. But you know, I have a 10-year plan, and I'm in year 3. So thank you.
Was
bright
and
allows
this skyscraper to build.
Yeah.
Because it's like, suppose that municipality need to protect this public interest. And which institution can do it? Not municipality.
We don't really have anyone protecting our interests as people in Britain. It's a very, I mean, it's only partially, you know, it's often held as being a great democracy, but. We have lots of problems with the way in which things are managed, and I think that personally, as someone who's British, I don't believe in the nation state and I don't believe in our democracy, because it doesn't represent people at almost any geopolitical scale. It's not like we have strong localism and a weak national democracy. I mean, we have weak, everything is weak, and this is, let me be very clear, this is the only product of neoliberal activities, and as you see it progress in your own country, you will see this as well. You will see a decline of the political sphere, you will see a rise in apathy, you will see a decline in the possibility of choice. All your politicians will come to represent corporate interests if they don't already, and you will see at every scale the exploitation of the citizen, who is no longer a citizen but a consumer. And this is like, you know, I mean, England in this respect, and especially London, it's when I go to places like Los Angeles, which I did a few months ago, it's like I can already see the roots of London 2014 in LA. LA is like London 1997, you know, it's like you can see the direction they're moving in, which is very worrying. So, there's no hope for that, I don't think. And yeah, you have all these kind of planning loopholes which allow you to do things like these bribes, which is effectively what it is.
Which big tenant
sure.
Would you like to